Chapter 32, A Jihad to Remember. No other Americans were in the first-class compartment when the two ISI men boarded the plane and escorted Charlie off before any of the other passengers. This time, Zia meant it when he said over dinner that he dearly wished he too could go inside. They agreed that when victory came, the two of them would ride down the main street of Kabul on white horses. "You'll have this memory until the day you die," Zia told Charlie warmly as he said goodbye. Brigadier Yusuf had brought two different Afghan outfits for Wilson to choose from. This time he'd been ordered to make sure that Wilson got into Afghanistan. It was an even more thankless assignment than the last, since the president expected the ISI to both insert Wilson into a hot combat zone and then to make sure he returned safely. Charlie was amazed at how tense Yusuf and his men were when they hit the road from Bonn to Miramshah. Hereditary kidnappers dominate the area. Pakistan has absolutely no control over these tribesmen, and about all the ISI men could do was drive fast and be ready to fight it out. It seemed terribly odd to Charlie that things could be so dangerous just trying to get to the war. As they approached the border, the scenes Charlie saw gave him the sensation of moving backward in time. They passed through towns that reminded him of stagecoach stops, only there were no women on the streets. The butchers' freshly slaughtered sheep and goats hung on hooks. The tribesmen all carried weapons. Most wore black or white cotton turbans, and their eyes blazed like car headlights. It wouldn't do to stare. These were not men to trifle with. Charlie found himself thinking of life in the Old West as Yusuf told him about the Pashtun's warrior tradition, how children are taught to withstand pain, how no boy cries after the age of 6, of the towering importance of revenge, how a Pashtun will wait generations, if necessary, to get even. He talked of their astonishing courage and orneriness, their total religious faith and their uncanny marksmanship, of how little they needed to sustain themselves in the field, and how they would bury their fallen comrades in the clothes and in the precise locations in which they'd died. For them, there is no greater honor than to be Shaheed, to die in the Jihad. Wilson had, of course, heard most of this before, but as he watched the spectacle of these people moving before his eyes, it was as if he were hearing it for the very first time, particularly when they came upon the mules and camels assembled for weapons runs inside. "Just acres and acres of camels and mules," Wilson remembers. He was never fully able to express the wonder of seeing this sight at the end of the 20th century, to actually see and smell and feel the oddness of it, the sense of being in another time, and the realization that this was the way these people fought their war, with camels and mules. He had known it and talked about it 100 times, but it was different here, seeing it firsthand. That was the beginning of Charlie's bright, shining moment. He was only in Afghanistan for 4 days, but he did it all. He actually rode a white horse. He wore the armor of these Muslim knights, a chitrali hat, shalwar kameez. An elite guard of the Pakistan Special Forces, dressed as Mujahideen, had been sent along to watch over him. 2 Stinger teams kept him in sight at all times. Charlie figured that not even Genghis Khan had ever had such bodyguarding. On the 2nd day, Charlie climbed the mountains overlooking Khost with Rahim Wardak, one of the 2 Afghan commanders chosen to guide him. They were moving from heat into the cold mountain air when it began to sleet, then snow. The Pakistanis told Wardak that Wilson had a terrible heart condition, that he shouldn't walk long distances. They tried to make him ride a horse, but he insisted on walking, and he was thrilled when they let him fire a salvo of rockets at a Soviet garrison. This was real. Instead of fighting the communists with words and legislation, Charlie was blasting a Soviet garrison with a CIA multiple-barrel rocket launcher. His money had bought the weapon, and now it was his finger pulling the trigger. This was not a free ride for the congressman, however, and before long the garrison's artillery was answering back, shells bursting close enough to fill the air with dirt and pebbles. This sent the combat-hardened Pakistani colonel into a panic. To Wardak's amazement, Colonel Mujahed leaped onto Charlie and pushed him to the ground. "I think someone told him he would be shot if anything happened to Charlie," Wardak says, adding that the entire Pakistan Special Forces contingent was in a state of constant tension those days, ready on a second's notice to hurl themselves into the defense of their charge. In marked contrast, the Mujahideen, with their total faith in Allah's will, acted as if the shells were not bursting by their sides. They just kept walking. For Wilson, these real-life combat moments were at once terrifying and exhilarating. The adrenaline allowed him to keep up with these inexhaustible mountain men, and on the outside, at least, he maintained a soldier's calm. Ironically, the only time he almost lost it came when he and Wardak approached a Mujahideen stronghold on a hillside over Khost. The Afghans, acting as if they were being attacked, issued forth great cries of Allahu Akbar and went on the offensive. "They just opened up with all their small arms," remembers Wilson. "It just scared the shit out of me, and I was already pretty anxious." Even Wardak acknowledges that it felt very much as if the Mujahideen were shooting right at them. But it was all meant as a friendly gesture, thousands of joy shots fired as a salute in honor of the great patron's arrival. Only once did Wilson come close to embarrassing himself in front of the warriors. They had decided it would be an insult to their guest if they failed to bring down a hind while he was there, so they initiated a noisy rocket barrage of the nearby garrison to draw the gunships to come out looking for them. Wilson had lived with the nightmare of the hind too long not to be spooked by the thought of one of them sweeping in to napalm or rocket or machine gun him to death. Two were now overhead, but high up. Charlie, helped along by his Pakistani protectors, scrambled for cover behind a rock. The Stinger operators, however, stood tall on the high ground. They were furious at the congressman's companions, hurling insults at them and demanding that they get into the vehicles and drive up and down the road to kick up dust and lure the hinds back in for the kill. It was the only time Wilson drew rank. He had no conviction about there being a place in paradise for him, so he sternly told the commander, "If you're doing this for me, please stop." By now, the aircraft had passed, and the Afghans did not interpret Wilson's words as an act of cowardice. That was inconceivable. They assumed he was just trying to protect their pride for having failed to bring down a beast in front of his eyes. Only later did Wilson fully appreciate the significance of what he had witnessed. The tables had been turned in this war. He was moving with an army of techno-guerrillas, swaggering about the Hindu Kush, looking for the opportunity to take on the biggest and baddest the Soviets had to offer. It's hard to fault Wilson for seeing only good in these men. Most American reporters were also dealing in two-dimensional portraiture when they sought to describe the Afghans. But in the dream Wilson was walking through, these were men without flaws. "Goodness personified," is the way he described Commander Haqqani, the fundamentalist mullah who guided him around Khost. The curious thing about Wilson's romance with these warriors is that he never got to know any one individual Mujahid. Deep down, he probably understood that he didn't dare, the magic might wear off. These were people whose language he did not speak, whose religion he did not share, and whose ordinary way of life, had it been imposed on Trinity, Texas, would have turned him into a revolutionary against them. But being with them in their mountains, as they defended their way of life, put Wilson in touch with a people who existed for Americans in the 20th century only in the world of myths and legends. There was a profound calmness to these men. They didn't move quickly, but they always moved deliberately. They turned together toward Mecca to pray to their God 5 times a day, but their faith was somehow an individual affair. Even young boys seemed transformed when they spoke of their religion. It was hard for Wilson not to admire and almost envy their faith. When they spoke, it was as if they were revealing divine truths. They were fighting Allah's battle against the atheists. They told him it was Allah who had caused Charlie Wilson to come to Paktia province, to accept the hospitality of his most faithful mullah, Jalaluddin Haqqani. It was the miracle of God that he had put kindness and mercy in the heart of the American congressman. "We had stood alone at first against the Soviet invader with bare hands. It is the bravery of the Afghan people that has attracted the foreigner to help.